Very interesting aspect here is the identity of the hunter with the animal.
You mean after the animal has been shot?
After the animal has been killed. The hunter then has to fulfill certain rites in a kind of participation mystique, a mystic participation with the animals whose death he has brought about and whose meat is to become his life. So the killing is not simply slaughter. At any rate, it's a ritual act. It's a recognition of your dependency and of the voluntary giving of this food to you by the animal who has given it. It's a beautiful thing. It turns life into a mythological experience.
The hunt becomes what?
It becomes a ritual. Mm-hmm. The hunt is a ritual.
Expressing a hope of resurrection, that the animal was food and you needed the animal to return.
And some kind of respect for the animal that was killed. That's the thing that gets me all the time in this hunting ceremonial system.
Respect for the animal.
Respect for the animal, and more than respect. I mean, that animal becomes a messenger of divine power, you see.
And you wind up as the hunter killing the messenger.
Killing the god.
What does this do? Does it cause guilt? Does it cause...
No, guilt is what is wiped out by the myth. It is not a personal act. You are performing the work of nature. For example, in Japan, in Hokkaido, northern Japan, among the Ainu people, whose principal mountain deity is the bear. When it is killed, there is a ceremony of feeding the bear a feast of its own flesh, as though he were present, and he is present. He served his own meat for dinner, and there's a conversation between the mountain god, the bear, and the people. They say, if you will give us the privilege of entertaining you again, we'll give you the privilege of another bear sacrifice.
If the cave bear were not appeased, the animals wouldn't appear, and these primitive hunters would starve to death. So they began to perceive some kind of power on which they were dependent, greater than their own.
And that's the power of the animal master. Now, when we sit down to meal, we thank God, you know, our idea of God for having given us this. These people thank the animal.
And is this the first evidence we have of an act of worship?
Yes.
Of power superior to man?
Yeah.
And the animal was superior because the animal provided food.
Well, now, in contrast to our relationship to animals, where we see animals as a lower form of life, and in the Bible we're told, you know, we're the masters and so forth, early hunting people don't have that relationship to the animal. The animal is in many ways superior. He has powers that the human being doesn't have.
And then certain animals take on a persona, don't they? The buffalo, the raven, the eagle.
Very strongly. Well, I was up in the northwest coast back in 1932. It was a wonderful trip. And the Indians along the way were still carving totem poles. The villagers had new totem poles still. And there we saw the ravens, and we saw the eagles, and we saw the animals that played roles in the myths. And they had the character, the quality of these animals. There's a very intimate knowledge and friendly, neighborly relationship to these creatures. And then they killed some of them, you see. The animal had something to do with the shaping of the myths of those people, just as the buffalo for the Indians of the plains played an enormous role. They're the ones that bring the tobacco of gift, the mystical pipe and all this kind of thing. It comes from a buffalo. And when the animal becomes the giver of a ritual and so forth, they do ask the animal for advice, and the animal becomes the model for how to live.
You remember the story of the buffalo's wife?
That's a basic legend of the Blackfoot tribe, and is the origin legend of their buffalo dance rituals.
By which they
invoke the cooperation of the animals in this play of life.